officially starting continuing in chapter 21. So we are roughly verse 33. Paul has just finished up his third missionary journey. Normally, when he finishes it up, he will go to Jerusalem and give a report, and then head back north down to Antioch, because Antioch is his home base. But in this particular case, he doesn't get to do that. He ends up in the temple, and he gets arrested, and that's basically where we find ourselves right now. But to get us caught up and so we can hit the ground running, chapter 21, verse 27. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was provoked, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. While they were seeking to kill him, the report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. At once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another. And when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of the people kept following them, shouting, "Away with him!" So this is basically where we ended up last Sunday. Paul's falsely accused, again, as is always the case. And as we talked last week, it would have been a crime punishable by death for Paul to have brought Trophimus the Greek into the temple or into the temple complex. Now remember, Greeks were allowed into a part of the temple complex, but not past a certain point. And they are basically saying that that is exactly what Paul did. And so what they should have done, had this been true, was call the temple guards. Temple guards would have investigated, and if it was found to be true, Paul and Trophimus both would have been executed. And the Romans allowed this. This was a concession that the Romans gave to the Jews and allowed them to do. But that was the only time that the Jews could put somebody to death. Otherwise, it had to be the Romans. However, they knew they didn't have a case because they did not call the temple guards. They called the crowd. And so, remember, the men of Asia, and what cities were in Asia? Think of the book of Revelation. Remember the seven churches? Laodicea, Sardis, Philadelphia, Ephesus. Okay? So all these men in that region, okay? And what was going on? What had just finished, by the way? Why were all these men of Asia even in the temple? What had just concluded? What was Paul rushing back to Jerusalem for? He was trying to get back to Pentecost, right? Okay? Because first you have Passover, and then how many days after Passover do you have Pentecost? 50 days. Pentecost means 50, right? So he was trying to get back for Pentecost. It had just finished. So a bunch of these men were still there, right? And so... And remember, Paul had been driven out of all of these cities. So not only would there be men or Jews from Asia there, but there would be Jews from Macedonia. There would be Jews from Achaia, which is where Corinth is. So all these Jews from all over the Roman Empire, which most of them would still be there. And all of those places, except for maybe Berea, these men, or Paul and his traveling companions, were always resisted and nearly always thrown out. So it would be very easy to stir up this crowd and cause a commotion, which is exactly what happened. So they were beating Paul. The Romans hear of it. We talked about last week about the Antonia Fortress there in the temple, which is where the commander was when he heard that all Jerusalem was in confusion, verse 31. He took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. Well, where's the down, right? Where's the up if he's going down? Well, that was the Antonia Fortress. They grab Paul, they put him into chains, which then fulfills the prophecy that Agabus had just made when they were in Caesarea. And he's trying to figure out what in the world's going on, what's all this uproar about. And because of the uproar of the crowd, he can't figure out what's going on. So he's going to take him into the barracks and basically beat him and torture him until he can get and find out what exactly is going on. As they get to the bottom of the stairs, the crowd is so bad that the soldiers have to pick up Paul and carry him along. Now, maybe Paul, because he had been beaten, wasn't traveling fast enough. Maybe it was just because of the crowd, but whatever the case, and this is saying something, because about how many soldiers, at a minimum, did the commander bring with him? How many? It's got to be at least two, because how many centurions did the commander bring with him? Well, more than one, because that's plural. So at least 200 Roman soldiers show up to this uproar. Well, apparently this uproar is so violent that this crowd has the danger of overcoming 200 Roman soldiers. That's a pretty large, violent crowd. These people are pretty upset with Paul. So when he gets to the stairs then, verse 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness." But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. And I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, dun, da, da, da. Now we have to wait to hear what he says. So the text that Luke says that Paul's mistaken for an Egyptian assassin. And I've mentioned the Jewish historian Josephus several times. And he does, in fact, mention this particular Jewish assassin. This was a man who basically duped a bunch of followers, saying that he had powers that he didn't have, and saying that basically I can make the walls of Jerusalem fall down. We will charge the city and we'll take over. Well, several hundred of his followers were killed, but he, in fact, escapes out into the wilderness. And these men were called Sicarii men. And we talked about this in chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost. Sicarii means dagger men. These men were an offshoot of the Zealots. The Zealots were a Jewish sect that said, we will resist Rome at all costs, including assassination. And so what these men would do is they would be walking in a crowd. They would have their target. They would reach into their cloak, pull out their dagger, kill their target, place it back in there, and disappear into the crowd. These are Sicarii men. And whoever thought reading the Bible was boring? I think it's pretty fascinating. And these men would not only kill Roman officials, but the Jews who would cooperate with the Romans. These men would resist the Romans at all costs. And in fact, these men were largely responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 when they caused a revolt in 66 AD. So he's mistaken for this leader of this revolt, and there's a little bit of some question as to why the commander says, "Do you know Greek?" Well, everybody spoke Greek, so why is the Roman commander saying, "You speak Greek?" And even if he confused him with the Egyptian Jews also spoke Greek. So there's some questions. You know, why are you saying this? Well, some say there was a problem with the translation, where he says, instead of saying, "Then you say, do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt." Instead, it is, "You know Greek. Then you are the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt." But the other possibility is exactly what the text says, in that the Greek that Paul spoke was an educated Greek, not the everyday common language Greek. And so just by Paul's demeanor and how he says it, the commander knows, oh, this guy is not just the average Greek. Right? He's somebody special. Regardless, Paul says, "Nope, that's not me." He explains to them he's a Jew from Tarsus. Yes, Ellen. Ellen, I need you to look up at me when you talk. Yes. Yes, that would be, I think that's his name. I do remember something about Thaddeus. Yeah, that would be the assassin's name. Yep. So he's a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, and we've talked about this before. Cilicia would be in southern Galatia and in the Phrygian region, and that particular city was a very large city, and it was the Roman capital in that particular province. Okay, very large city, very well known as a city of learning, and so Paul is from there, and he says, I'm not this Egyptian. I'm in fact a Jew from Tarsus. Allow me to speak to the people." And there's it's a little bit strange that the commander goes ahead and allows him to do this. However, he's probably thinking, well, maybe I can get some more information and find out who this guy is and what it is that he's done. So he does in fact allow him to speak to the people. And you know, he had bound him to these two guards. Well, apparently it would appear that they've maybe freed him, because he raises his hands to get the crowd's attention, letting them know, "Hey, I want to speak." And so the crowd go ahead and lets him speak. Verse 40, "And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect." And Hebrew dialect is in Aramaic, which is what the New Testament is, or actually New Testament that we're looking at is going to be in Greek, because it is the Septuagint. But he speaks to him in the Hebrew dialect, which is Aramaic. All right? And then which seems to me kind of a weird chapter break, his speech then begins in 22 and verse 1. Any questions about so far about chapter, or comments about chapter 21? Hold on. Huh? What about the microphone? Can't hear. David, give us a little more sound, if you would, please.
Yeah, verse 37. Who said, "Do you know Greek?"
The Roman commander.
Okay. And then he spoke to them, Paul spoke to them in Hebrew.
In Hebrew, right. So he spoke to the commander in Greek, what we think would be an educated Greek, but he's speaking to the crowd in Hebrew or in Aramaic, which would be the Hebrew language. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Anybody else? Comments or questions? All right. Well, then I've got some questions for you. All right, number one, how would you outline the chapter? Anybody want to share how they would outline the chapter? Nobody? All right, here's what I got. Paul travels from Miletus to Jerusalem, right? Remember, he's headed back to Jerusalem. He's trying to get there for the Passover. He doesn't stop in Ephesus, but he does go to Miletus. From Miletus, he calls for the elders, and he speaks to the elders from Miletus. That's from 1 and verse 16. 17 through 26, Paul recounts his journey to James and the elders. When he gets to Jerusalem, remember he ends up in going down to Caesarea, right, on the coast, and Tyre and all those. So finally he gets to Jerusalem and he tells James and the elders about what happened. That's then also when he is asked to purify himself and to pay the expenses of the men, four men under a vow, so that everybody could know that the things that were said about Paul were not true. 27 through 30, Paul is seized in the temple and beaten, which we just covered. Paul is rescued from the mob by soldiers 31 through 36, 37 through 40. Paul asks to speak to the crowd. So that could be simplified to probably three, but that's what I came up with. Again, there's no real wrong answer. It's just how I saw it. Number two, what would you use for chapter headings? Any suggestions? Again, not necessarily wrong answers, just what helps you to remember what's in the chapter. For chapter 19 and 20, this is what I'm using. I'm sorry? Well, we've been doing two headings, right? Maybe it's just one, maybe it's three. Any suggestions about what you would put in there to help you remember what's in the chapter?
End of the third journey.
End of the third journey, and I've got end of first journey by mistake, but the end of the third journey is what I got. Yeah, and you might just do end of the first journey. I do think, and I would highly suggest, if you have your charts with you and you're keeping track of it, I would definitely do end of first journey. That's pretty major.
Third journey.
I was in there reading my mistake, which I already acknowledged. End of third journey, I definitely would put in there. Would you need something else? Maybe not. But I went ahead and I put down Paul's arrested in the temple. That's kind of the same as the end of the third journey, right? But by saying that Paul is arrested in the temple, it's that act that starts his journey to Rome. Okay? So, and some call this the fourth journey, because while he is under arrest, what does he do as he goes? He's preaching, right? And especially once he gets to Rome, he's going to be in Rome for 2 years under house arrest, and the Romans allow him to have visitors. He calls the Jewish elders in Rome to him, and he preaches to them. And obviously, if he's got a soldier attached to either side of him on his journey, you think he's just going to keep silent? He's got a captive audience. He's going to be preaching. So some call that the fourth journey. So that's why I put down there, end of the third journey, Paul is arrested in the temple. Number three, sailing from Miletus, list the locations passed through as they traveled to Tyre. What do we got? So starting from Miletus, what's next? Kos, Rhodes, Patara. What did he keep on the left? Cyprus, he kept on the left. And then they landed in Tyre.
Right. T-Y-R-E, all right?
And
Kos or Kos, I don't know.
And Rhodes, both of those were islands, right? It was not a city,
but it is mentioned. Number four, how did the gospel first reach Phoenicia?
So this is not in chapter 21. You'd have to do some digging and research and note-taking and things of that nature in order to find this answer.
Yep. In Acts 11, verse 20, Luke says that when the persecution started after the death of Stephen, some of those who scattered went to Phoenicia, speaking the word of the Lord to the Jews only.
But then it says, but some went to Antioch and to Phoenicia,
speaking also to the Greeks. So this would have happened during the events of chapter 8, though mentioned in chapter 11. Right? So this would have happened in the events of chapter 8
due to the persecution of Stephen,
but mentioned in chapter 11. Number 5, what was the common request made of Paul on his way to Jerusalem?
Very simply, don't go. Don't go. Right? Even Luke, eventually, after Agabus had made his prophecy, even Luke
said, don't go. Number 6, who did Paul and his traveling companions stay with while in Caesarea? Think I heard it? Philip the evangelist. What is he known for? He was one of the seven.
What else do we know about him? Because we've heard from him before. He had four daughters who were prophetesses. What else?
He converted the Ethiopian eunuch. Who else?
He baptized the Samaritans and Simon the sorcerer.
Okay. All those in chapter 8. Question number 8. Which Caesarea is this, and what is special about this city?
Remember, there were two. Anybody remember what the two were?
A little louder?
So this one was Maritima or Maritima. I think it's pronounced Maritima, but don't quote me on that.
That's how I say it anyway.
The other one is Caesarea Philippi. That's where Jesus asked his apostles, who do the people say I am? And this is where Peter says, you are Jesus, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, upon this rock, all right, we'll call you Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, whatever. Anyway, right? So that's Philippi, Caesarea Philippi. This
on the coast is Caesarea Maritima. What else do we know about it?
Built by Herod the Great.
Built by Herod the Great?
Home of Pilate. Roman capital.
It is the Roman capital in Palestine. Very good. Say it one more time.
First Gentile
converted in what chapter? Those pesky chapter headings again. Chapter 10.
That's right.
And we talked about how Herod built this city basically from a little fishing village to this grandiose, just magnificent city, marble streets and all this kind of stuff.
It would have been absolutely amazing.
and it had a man-made harbor that Herod built. And it actually had underwater concrete. And recently I read that they have kind of figured out how the Romans did that. Very interesting. And Paul has visited this city on numerous occasions and will continue to visit this as he leaves under arrest to head to Rome. Number 9, which James is this in verse 18? So when he gets to Jerusalem, it says that he speaks to James and the elders. Which James is this?
The Lord's brother, or the Lord's half-brother, if you wish.
Number 10, who is missing from the group of men Paul addresses in verse 18? Where might they be?
The apostles.
The apostles, right? And we kind of talked about this. It's like, hey, you're going to talk to James and the elders. Every time we ever talk about Jerusalem, the apostles are there. There's no mention of them. Okay, so where might they be? Preaching the gospel, doing exactly what Jesus commanded them, making disciples and being witnesses. Matthew 28 and Acts chapter 1. What have the Jewish Christians heard about Paul? What have the Jewish Christians heard about Paul, though, that got them all upset? Okay. Specifically, what was the charge? There you go. That he was teaching the Jews who lived among the Gentiles to forsake Moses by teaching them not to circumcise their children and to forsake the customs of Moses. Number 12, what did James and the elders request of Paul? Was this sinful? Why or why not? Okay.
To demonstrate continued adherence to the Torah and to counterfeit false accusations of apostasy.
Yep. And we talked about this last week, and there's a lot of questions about, Paul, what in the world are you doing, right? And there are men who, brilliant scholars, you know, Greek-speaking, Hebrew-speaking, I mean, men that are just brilliant, understand God's word, highly respected, and they don't agree. Some will say, Paul sinned. Period. He shouldn't have done it. He's going back on the law of Christ. He's going back to the old law. And, of course, the other, you know, very far into the gamut is he did absolutely no wrong, whatever, right? So there's just lots of questions about it. We talked about it last week. The request was that he would ceremonially purify himself and then pay the expenses of these four Jewish men who were under a vow. And we think that vow was a Nazirite vow. And so there would be sacrifices that would have to be made, and of course the expenses of it. And so the request was, is by you participating in this, will show that these charges were in fact false. And we talked about how the charge about circumcision was absolutely false. And how do we know that was false? One of the most glaring, obvious things that we know, that Paul was not telling people not to circumcise their children. He had Timothy circumcised, his traveling companion, right? Timothy had not been circumcised because his father was a Greek, and even though his mother was a Jew, he wasn't circumcised. Paul needed to take Timothy with him. He needed to take him into places where, in order for Timothy to go, he'd have to be circumcised. So he did so. But he did not say it had to be done for the purpose of salvation. Because that was what was happening with Titus. And Paul says, I did not give in to them for a moment and did not circumcise Titus. So as long as it's not done as a matter of salvation, or you're binding it on others, it was fine. So these charges against Paul were in fact false. So the elders were like, well, let's go ahead and let's show these Jewish brethren who've heard these false things, these assumptions and things like that, that it is incorrect. So Paul in fact does do this, right? Did he fulfill their request? Number 13, yes. Was it sinful? And because of the fact for me, because Luke does not show, record any type of rebuke of any kind. Among the other things we talked about last week, I do not believe that it was sinful. He was simply trying to keep the peace. He didn't bind it on others. He said that when he was with Jews, he would live as a Jew so that he might save some. When he was with Gentiles, he would do the exact same thing so that he might save them as well. Since it wasn't done for salvation or binding it on others, it was not sinful. It was done to keep the peace with the Jewish brethren. That's what I have. It's a pretty sticky, really muddy type of thing that's going on, and lots of questions. So, any questions or comments about question 12?
Could it be something like, he's all things to all men, just like you don't cause your brother to stumble by maybe, I don't know, not eating a certain meat that might make that brother feel uncomfortable? Could it be that that's what he was doing?
Well,
it's not a sin.
Right. Well, and that's, again, that is kind of what we talked about last week, about how in Romans 14, Paul says that some people, you know, who's coming out of idolatry, they can't eat this meat that's been offered to an idol, because if they did, it would violate their conscience. Paul says, then don't eat the meat, because if you do eat it, you're sinning, because you think that you're doing wrong. Even though it's not, you think it is, therefore it's wrong. And as a Christian who knows that it's wrong, it would be wrong for you to tell that person you have to eat that meat. Or, nah, go ahead and eat it, it's fine. To convince them to eat the meat even though they thought it was wrong would be wrong on your part as well. And so, in this particular case, and again, going back to circumcision, Paul said in Galatians, circumcision is nothing, and not circumcision is nothing. Right? As long as you didn't bind it. Or he had made the comment about special days, right? To the Jew, Passover was a special day. Pentecost was a special day. If every year, if you wanted to remember it as a national holiday, that's fine. But don't tell the other person next to you that they have to or they're sinning. Now, we also talked about how this time in the first century was a period of transition. And also, God revealed his will in stages as the people could accept it. Remember in Acts chapter 2, Peter is preaching his sermon, and he says, all who call on the name of the Lord shall be saved, quoting from Joel 2. Peter said it, but it's clear Peter didn't realize that all men also included Gentiles. Peter didn't realize that until chapter 10. So he revealed it in stages. So this is a period of transition, and there were certain things that while, you know, they could do, but, you know, he's doing it, he's allowing them to do that. And I think that's a lot of what's happening here with Paul. But again, last week we said this period of transition that God is allowing is going to end. And when is that? When will this period of transition end?
Well, the destruction of Jerusalem is one. He said all men everywhere will be called to repent. He allowed repentance for a while, but
right.
The destruction of Jerusalem pretty much done.
Yeah, so the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, when the Romans came in and destroyed the city, broke down the temple, there's no more temple. Right? There's no place for you to take your sacrifice to. Right? So God, at that point, God says, okay, this transitional period, we're done. There's a clear separation. Right? For you and I, all we've ever known, we've never offered sacrifices before. But for them, this is what they've always done. So this was a period of transition. Eventually, God will bring that transition to an end. All right, number 14. What charges were brought against Paul by the Jews from Asia?
He brought a Gentile into the temple.
Okay. He brought a Greek into the temple and defiled it. Also, he preached against the people, the law, and the temple. Number 15, Paul would have been killed if not for who? What did he do? What does this action fulfill? Okay, specifically, the Roman commander. What's the Roman commander's name? Do we know his name? In chapter 21, we don't know it. But later, when Paul appeals to Caesar, the Roman commander writes a letter. And he says, it doesn't seem right for me to deliver this criminal to you without knowing the charge. And he addresses it. It is. Claudius Lysias. The Roman commander is Claudius Lysias. Very good, Rebecca. 23, verse 26. And he wrote a letter having this form, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. All right, so there you go. We know his name. And what did he do? What did the Roman commander do to Paul?
Took him into custody, bound him with two chains.
And what did this action fulfill? Yeah, the prophecy of Agabus earlier on in this chapter. Number 16, who did he think Paul was? An Egyptian assassin who had earlier led a revolt and escaped into the wilderness. Number 17, where did they take Paul and what was its formal name?
The barracks, the Antonio Fortress.
That is correct. Into the barracks, known as Antonio Fortress or Fortress Antonia. Number 18, your application's key point, takeaways, things that stood out for you in this chapter. Anybody want to share one?
Paul went anyway.
Paul. That's what I got, Paul's resolve. My comments on that was, even though Paul is told time and time again through the Spirit that hardships and trials awaited him at Jerusalem, he goes anyway. Of course, he had known that he would suffer for Jesus since the beginning in chapter 9. Would we be as eager to do what he did, knowing that persecution is going to be at this place where I'm headed? Would I go anyway? To go to Jerusalem knowing that bad things were going to happen to us, even if we knew it was God's will, would you or could you do it? All right. Anybody got anything else they want to share before I give you my last one?
To me, that is the number one thing that hits me about Jesus dying for us. He knew. We're told to have a good attitude in troubles, but Jesus knew what he was going to go through, and you wonder if that crossed Paul's mind as well, but Paul couldn't stop it. Jesus could have stopped it. To me, that is just such an ultimate sacrifice to know it's coming, to go through it even when you can stop it.
Yep. And remember, we talked about this, there is some similarities between Jesus' drive to Jerusalem in the Gospels and Paul's drive to Jerusalem as he's on his way there, being told, you know, Jesus knew because he was God, but Paul is told by God this is going to happen. So it's pretty, very similar. The last one I got then is the forgiveness of Philip. Philip was one of the seven. Stephen was one of the seven. Paul was a party to the death of Stephen, a co-worker of Philip's. It was Paul who was largely responsible for the persecution that scattered the church after the death of Stephen, and yet Paul and his eight other traveling companions are staying with Philip in his house. Could Philip have held a grudge or mistrusted or not forgiven Paul? Yeah. Could you have forgiven Paul as Philip had? One of your best friends is murdered. Later on, several years later, you find out that the murderer has repented, has now become a Christian. He calls you to the prison. He wants to talk with you. Could you forgive him, become a co-worker with him in a prison ministry type work?
What if he got out of prison and he's on parole and he wants to come stay with you?
There you go.
I think that would be harder. He wants to come stay at my house.
This guy's murdered your friend. He's out on parole. He has no place to stay. Would you allow him to stay on the street?
I know.
Well, that's what that's what Philip did, right? Was it wise? I don't know, but he did it, right? Anyway, Jesus taught that we must forgive others if we want to be forgiven by God. Matthew 6, Matthew 18, Mark 11, 25. If we want to be forgiven by Jesus, we need to forgive those who have wronged us. And with that, I did not get to chapter 22. You jinxed me. Easier said than done, though, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And we all know that.
It seems like Paul, though, his drive was, it seems like, I did all these things against these people, and now I have a chance to redeem myself, and I got to work to the death to do this because I caused so much death. So, I mean, he had a driving factor, and he had unbelievable focus.
Well, imagine the guilt Paul felt. He now has the opportunity to ask Philip, forgive me. I know what I've done. And Philip accepts it. I'm way, 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 way over. Thank you so much for your comments.